This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Khoo Sitrong, and it's time for Ringgit and Cents, the show that's all about personal finance. Today we're going to be discussing the pros and cons on an overseas education and how it impacts your wallet. Helping us tease out the issues are Jason Wee and Ng Jun Tian, representing US Apps, which is an NGO aimed at informing the Malaysian public about higher education in the US. If you have any questions, please WhatsApp 018-789-8899, which is 018-789-8899, or tweet at BFM Radio. Now, just a bit of background, Jason, you are a political economy student at Princeton University, Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public International Affairs, and Jun Kian, you are a graduate of USC, University of Southern California. You work at the EPU right now under Dato' Rahman Dahlan, and you are an incoming Rhodes Scholar pursuing a master's degree at Oxford University. What message do you bring us this fine morning? Jun Kian.
I think the question today is overseas education a sound investment? If we look at the ringgit today, I think I just checked last night, it's about 4.2-ish per US dollar. Of course, as opposed to my time, around 2013, 2014, of between 3.1 to 3.3 ringgit per dollar. Of course, the price has gone up tremendously. But I don't want to talk about this from a purely financial perspective because education doesn't really give you a direct financial return. So I want you to imagine education like a marriage. So how do you know when a marriage is a sound investment? You know a marriage is a sound investment when you have found the right one. And the organization that I represent, US Apps, I want you to think of US Apps as a dating agency. We are trying to help you to find the right university, of course, more particularly in the US. And I believe when you have found the right university, which is worth your time, which will give you phenomenal academic experience and personal growth, and then that university is worth your time and money.
Well, there's a lot of assumptions here because it presupposes that you want to go to the US in the first place, and it presupposes that you even qualify to get into an Ivy League university in the first place, right, Jun Kian? Because not everybody can get into, you know, Wharton or Stanford or you know, Princeton or whatever. You know, Jason, you went to Princeton actually, and you're in the public affairs department. How did it work out for you? Why not Australia? Why not the UK? Why the US?
So one thing I think it's important to note about US education, especially its admission policies, is that it's not particularly geared academically. It's actually pretty holistic. So as opposed to the UK system where you have to get a certain grade, you have to score a certain amount of A's or A-levels or whatever examination you're taking, the US looks at you holistically. So although you might not be as strong academically, you might possibly have a very sharp co-curricular perspective that you might bring to the table, which might give you to the admissions. So for my case, for example, I don't think I'm necessarily the most academic student. Sure, I think I did okay in school. I think what brought me and what I felt that the U.S. looked at me was my extracurricular activities. I was very involved in debate. So when you do have those particular nuances and kinks into your personality, U.S. really does appreciate that. I think that's really important, especially for Malaysian students, especially since like the opportunities we get here are sometimes academically aren't especially great as opposed to other countries. I think the activities we got here can give us a competitive edge, especially when applying to the US.
Again, if you have any questions for Jason or Jun Kian, please WhatsApp 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899, or tweet at BFM Radio. Now, of course, you know, the question that a lot of graduates or, you know, graduate wannabe graduates in Malaysia always consider, is it Australia? Is it the UK? Is it local? Is it the US? Now, it's obviously something that they have to consider along with their parents when they come to that inflection point in their lives. What kind of thought processes should the young person be fathoming at that age?
Okay, I think I'll go first. But first of all, I want to go back to the question you mentioned earlier about Harvard, Yale, Princeton, MIT, right? So let's go back to the example.
In terms of qualification to Ivy League universities,
yes.
Okay.
But qualification is one thing. Whether or not you can get in, that's one thing, right? But whether you like it there is another thing. Like, let me go back to my marriage example, right? A lot of Asian parents or Malaysian parents, more particularly, they want their children to go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, MIT, or Stanford because these are the only U.S. universities they know. It's as if telling your children to marry David Beckham. If you're good enough, of course, David Beckham might like you, but would you really be happy with him? That is my question,
okay.
Right?
If you're a girl, vote if you're a guy then.
Yes.
No, but that's what you're trying to say.
Okay, maybe for a guy, you know, Kim Kardashian, maybe if you want to marry Kim Kardashian, like, you might be good enough for Kim Kardashian, but will you like her?
Yeah.
That's my point, right? You might be qualified to get into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, MIT, and Stanford, but whether it is a good fit for you, whether it is worth your time and money to go to that school, it's an entirely different question.
I mean, certainly there's a lot of universities in the US which are outside of the top tier, and they're still very good as if not better. But, you know, obviously, you've got to be a certain kind of person to want to go to the US, is that right?
Yeah, I think the common presumption about the US universities is that it's very monolithic, right? I think US is a enormous place, especially in comparison to Australia and the UK as well. Because in the US, you have a lot of Western schools, Western Coast schools, which Jun Ken went to, the California school system. I go to the East Coast school, which just features more smaller liberal arts places. And then you have, obviously, the Southern schools, which are big state universities. So you really do have that diversity of what kind of experience you want to look for. Do you want to look for a small, intimate community where you have very intimate relationships with your professors, or do you want to have a very, you know, stereotypical American experience in a campus setting? I think those are really experiences that are on the table that often people miss out on.
Can you guys rewind to back when you're 17, 18 years old and you're, you know, doing well in school, obviously, but then considering what happens at tertiary level? Do you go to the UK? Do you stay local and pay local and not burden your parents with all kinds of costs? Or do you go to the US, which is a lot further away, albeit, but you have a lot of the top schools like the MITs and the Princetons of this world? I mean, for example, you, Jun Ken, what went through your mind when you evaluated the process at that point in time?
I think I wasn't as good a student as you portrayed I was when I was in high school. So because the decision of going to the US wasn't entirely made by me. I was a top scorer in SPM and I really didn't know where to go. And my mom was just like, maybe you want to apply for a scholarship and go somewhere overseas. Because I came from a single-parent family. My mom wasn't able to send me anywhere else except for local universities. But if you get a scholarship, maybe you can go somewhere. So eventually, I did get the Public Service Department JPA scholarship. And I initially asked for Australia or the UK, but they gave me the United States. And after the decision was made, I did a lot more research about applying to schools in the U.S. and the school system in the U.S. And that really made me feel interested, you know, about going to the U.S., which is why we are doing this right now. We are trying to tell Malaysian students that, you know, beyond the traditional U.K. and Australia route, we believe U.S. has something different to offer, which is the liberal arts education philosophy. And the liberal arts education philosophy, it's about producing holistic graduates. It's about studying classes from different disciplines. Like, my major was mechanical engineering, but I took classes from 12 different departments at USC, including philosophy, sociology, writing, and political science. And of course, a lot of people will be asking, if you just want to be an engineer, why take classes from 12 different departments? And I remember the very first thing that my professor once said to me is that you might be the smartest engineer in the world, but if you cannot write, then what's the point? The knowledge will just stay in your head.
No, good point. Jason, I mean, have you always been this confident? I mean, you seem to be very, you know, verbose and very eloquent. You know, have you always been that way?
I mean, so I think my personal education in Malaysia as well contributed a lot. But I think my decision to go to the US was twofold, right? Number one, I think there's a common thing where Malaysians don't really know what they want to do, right? So I think a lot of my friends enter degree programs they're not sure they actually want to enter those fields. I think the US does offer some flexibility where you don't declare your major until your second year. So for example, although I'm definitely going to declare under the Woodrow Wilson School, I can obviously easily switch to econs or sociology or any department under the umbrella, right? For example, you could also take classes. So last semester, I took an introduction to computer science class, and that's really brought into WIF. But moreover, I think my decision to go to the US was a financial one, right? I think it was, since the U.S. does offer substantial financial aid, it was actually cheaper for me to go to the U.S. as compared to a full-paying fee in the U.K. or Australia, for the case.
It is Ringgit and Sense, the personal financial that brings you everything to do with your personal finances. And we are talking to Jason Wee and Ng Jun Ken, who are both representing U.S. apps, an NGO aimed at informing the Malaysian public and about higher education in the U.S. After this, we're going to come back with more of your views, gentlemen. BFM 89.9.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is I'm Khoo Soo Chung, and it's time for Ringgit Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. We are talking to Jason Wee and Ng Jun Ken. They represent US Apps, which is an NGO aimed at informing the public about higher education in the US. Now, let's talk about the financials of the whole equation here. You know, for example, you, Jason, you have gone to, you are still in Princeton, actually, and over a 4-year basis, which is the duration of your degree. That's about 600,000 US plus board plus tuition. That's about 2.5 million, 2.7 million ringgit current terms. And as you, Junkian, you also, you went to, I think, USC, University of Southern California. That's about, what, 75,000 a year? About 100,000 US dollars a year over 4 years. So 400,000 ringgit. 200,000 US dollars, which is about 2.2, 2.3 million ringgit. Current exchange rates, not cheap. Okay, so for parents and children who are now discussing this whole option, what kind of financial assistance can people consider?
So I think one concept that people really don't know about the U.S. and they should know is this concept of financial aid. So in the U.S., most universities do offer financial aid where once you do get into the university, once you gain admission, they make sure that you can pay to go. So for a lot of universities, particularly five universities in the U.S. right now, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Amherst, and MIT, they offer full international need-blind admission. So that means no matter what you put on paper, what, how much you can pay, they'll still look at you as an eligible candidate. After you get in, for example, they will make sure that adjusting to what your family earns, you can pay the appropriate amount. So most people that do go into the U.S. don't pay the full amount at all. In fact, right now, I think in my personal education, I only pay for board and food. I don't pay for tuition because the financial aid system adjusts to what I can pay based on what my family earns. And for most Malaysians, in fact, I think the benchmark, it's compared to the dollar to the dollar. I think for the benchmark for most American universities, if you earn below 60,000 US dollars a year, you're eligible for almost full tuition fee. So that's like a big financial up for your for someone that is studying in the US, because effectively you really do only pay for your living costs.
So on what basis does the university give you this assistance?
So what you do in the application process, so after you get admitted, you submit your tax documents. So you submit how much you earn, and then you come back with a financial decision whether, and then they'll tell you how much you need to pay based on need analysis. And it's not just the big schools, really. A lot of small liberal arts schools in the U.S. really do offer a very generous financial package. I think Bates College, like Wesleyan, does offer like substantial financial aid that really does minimize your cost of education.
So you're going to stick around in the U.S. after you graduate and, you know, probably get a job in Silicon Valley or something? Maybe join Zuck?
Personally, no. I really want to come back. I don't have much intention to stay in the U.S. Particularly because I'm more interested in working here. But a lot of people do stay on. I know that there's a lot of talk about the B2 visa and how people are struggling to get it because of Trump's cutting back on their particular policy. I think that does apply for people who are necessarily don't achieve higher degrees and more skilled universities. But I think if you can get a job in, for example, Silicon Valley or Wall Street, those are very actual, real realities that people are considering on the table. And that's a possible chance of if you do study in the U.S., you know?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the financial assistance part of it. But Junkian, there's also the other aspect, which is basically academic qualifications and getting full scholarships.
Right, yes. I think there is an important distinction here to make. There is financial aid in the U.S. and there is also scholarships in the U.S. Financial aid is income-based, and scholarship is merit-based. So, for example, financial aid, once you get into the school, if it's a need-blind school, then they will give you financial aid for international students. But my school, USC, that I went to, there is no financial aid for international students, which means it doesn't matter what kind of income you have. They just don't give financial aid, right? But we do have scholarships for international students. It's divided into three categories: full scholarship, half scholarship, that means you pay half the tuition, and quarter scholarship, that means you pay 75% of the tuition. But that is merit-based. That means you have to be academically competitive. But beyond that, of course, there's also scholarships offered by local institutions. For example, I was on the Public Service Department scholarship, which was a government scholarship. I understand it's been suspended, but there are still many corporate scholarships here in Malaysia. And like you mentioned just now, you asked Jason whether he was going to stay back in the U.S. and all that. I just want to say, if you do take a scholarship from local institutions, it's very important that you come back. Because one of the reasons that the Public Service Department scholarship was suspended is because the students never came back. So from the government side, it's a terrible investment, right? And you are literally destroying the future generations now because they cannot get scholarships. So if you do get a scholarship from local institutions, it's very, very important that you eventually return.
I guess that's why you're, part of the reason because you took a PhD scholarship. You're with the EPU now under Dr. Raman Dalan. But, in the course of your work at the USAPS, which is the NGO, trying to advise parents and kids, do you find there's more kids going to the US now than Australia or the UK? Or is it kind of like declining in interest?
So from what I know, I think there's a bit of a mix. So in terms of USAPS, there have been increasingly less people applying or coming to U.S. apps, which you really want to encourage more because the opportunities in the U.S., especially since a lot of colleges are looking to diversify, therefore they're willing to take a lot more international students, is really a big up. And so I think we were here to really publicize that and really push that message out. But in terms of where Malaysians are going abroad, I think a lot of people are limited to their purview of the UK and Australia, particularly because that's what they know. You probably know someone who went to the UK or Australia. I think that's the main reason why people go there. I think that's one of the reasons why, for example, in London, you're just so many Malaysians there, right? And you don't really get that immersive experience that you might have in the US. So in the US, a lot of universities are campus-based, where you live on campus, you have very intimate connections with people. I think that's one of the scarier things for Malaysians, right? Going into an uncharted territory, entering a new environment you're not used to. So for those particular Malaysians, I think that's maybe slightly off-putting. But obviously the flip side to that is that you can learn so much more when you explore outside of your comfort zones and really push yourself to talk to people you're probably not used to, and you can't turn to any other Malaysian and just say, I want to hang out with my little Malaysian circle, my Malaysian dinner right now. I have to interact with people, unless I was just probably stick in my room and slightly be not really socialized in that sense. So I think really there's a trade-off. Perhaps Malaysians are scared of entering this new uncharted, like amazingly large land that is America, that is United States of America, but the trade-off is that your experience is just so much more immersive.
Yeah, I mean, speaking from personal experience, when you go to the UK, which is where I was, you have little Malaysian groups, you know, and there was never any kind of like intermixing with other cultures and other races, and it's a bit defeating in terms of purpose in the UK. Junkian, so, I mean, is there a message that you bring to the public here from US apps, which is obviously very US-centric?
Yes, I guess one of the reasons U.S. apps was started, actually, so according to official statistics, there is only about 7,000 Malaysian students in the U.S. across hundreds of universities.
Is that right? Just 7,000? Yes, so 7, compared 000. To the U.K., how many?
So as far as we know, in U.K. and Australia, there's about 20,000 each. So 20,000 Malaysian students across a few universities in the U.K. and a few universities in Australia. But it's 7,000 across hundreds of universities in the U.S. So every school has so few Malaysian students. For example, my school, when I was there were 10 Malaysians, There were 10 Malaysians at the Malaysian Student Association, and there were only 4 active members, the president, the vice president, the secretary, and the treasurer. And in that scenario, you really have to interact with the locals. You really have to immerse yourself in a completely new environment. In fact, learning...
But even in California, because the locals are not always just white Americans, you've got a lot of Latinos, you've got Koreans, you know, all kinds of stuff.
I had a huge culture shock because in your mind, you keep thinking, like, Hollywood is such a white place.
And then but it's not, right?
And when I arrived in L.A., I just realized in L.A. downtown, there's only 20% of first language English speakers.
Yeah.
Most of them are Spanish speakers.
It's a bit like going to London now. You guys like 20% white English and the rest of them from, you know, other parts of the world.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of having, you know, an international or a foreign education, because it's the international part of it. Being able to interact with people from every corner of the world, that is world-class education.
So how do people get in touch with both of you and get a bit of a, you know, a elaborated, detailed explanation of going to the U.S.? How do people get in touch with you guys?
So on the 5th and 6th of August, U.S. Apps is organizing a workshop at Taylor's Lakeside College, right? So you can log on to our Facebook page. If you just search U.S. Apps, U.S. APPS, or if you go to usapps.org, you can have, we have a lot of facilitators that have been to the US, have been to like a diverse amount of like universities you can never imagine, and you can have personal interactions with them there.
Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station. Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.